From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, the eyes of the world are on Rome. Pope John Paul II has reportedly been given the sacrament of the sick and dying, what has long been called the last rites. The 84-year-old leader of the world's 1 billion Catholics has been struggling with Parkinson's disease and sharply declining health. In February, he was hospitalized with the flu and has been in and out of the hospital ever since. Yesterday, the Vatican announced the pontiff had been fitted with a feeding tube. John Paul II was the first non-Italian pope in almost 500 years. He was elected pope in 1978, the first Polish Catholic to sit on St. Peter's throne. The charismatic, athletic pope quickly made his presence felt far beyond Vatican City. John Paul II was the first pope to visit a mosque, the first to visit a synagogue, and he is credited with a pivotal role in the downfall of the Soviet Union. In 1981, he survived an assassination attempt in St. Peter's Square. John Paul II has been a fierce traditionalist, and not without critics. The pope found himself increasingly at odds with many American Catholics in recent years on the role of women in the church, on birth control, on gay rights, and his handling of the priest sex abuse scandal. As he has struggled for his own life, the Vatican was deeply involved in the American controversy over Terri Schiavo, who died today. So, a big canvas, and in the middle of it, a pope tonight struggling for his life. You can join our conversation this evening. What are your thoughts, your prayers tonight on and for Pope John Paul II? How would you describe his impact on the Catholic Church as he fights for his life tonight, his impact on the world, on your life? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We may be hoping to hear from the Vatican this evening for the latest on the Pope's health. In the meantime, joining me right now in the studio is Stephen Pope. He's Associate Professor of Theology at Boston College. He's an authority on the papacy and the leadership structure of the Church. He is co-editor of the book Common Calling, The Laity and the Governance of the Church. Stephen Pope, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Ardsley-on-Hudson, New York, we're joined by Sydney Callahan, a psychologist who writes on moral theology and ethics. She wrote an article in the Washington Post this weekend headlined, Opening the Papacy to New Ways of Thinking. She's formerly a columnist for Commonweal magazine, a journal of opinion run by lay Catholics. She's author of In Good Conscience, Reason and Emotion in Moral Decision-Making. Sydney Callahan, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So we find ourselves, Stephen, Sydney, at this awkward moment. People in the Vatican being quoted today as increasingly pessimistic about the Pope's recovery. Following the news, he is reportedly responding to antibiotics. He's got a urinary tract infection in addition to everything else that he's dealt with in recent weeks and years, for that matter. No one knows how this turns out, but we can, and of course, as we've been told tonight, the last rites are often administered repeatedly near life's end and not necessarily at death's door, but clearly a struggle for life underway in the Vatican tonight. We're making no presumptions about what happens here. This pope has been administered last rites before after an assassination attempt on his life and recovered, and he's been very strong in coming to the window and attempting to commune with Roman Catholics in confronting the illness that he's struggling with tonight. Stephen Pope, as you look out from our distant vantage here, whatever happens, this is a pope with a tremendous legacy that survives him already quite apart from whatever happens here on out.
Well, there's no doubt, Tom, John Paul II is the first global pope, someone who's had name and face recognition in more societies, more communities than any other pope and perhaps any other human being, given the length of his pontificate, 26 years, and his energy for travel, crisscrossing the globe, the ability to use air transportation, but also media, television, radio. He's the most published pope of all time by a significant factor. And he's a pope who's always had enormous energy for engaging whatever issues contemporary people were worried about or suffered over, would engage their imagination. This pope has not been afraid to enter into those issues and try to address them, always with the same message. It's been the message of human dignity and social justice. Mm. And, of course, now his state of having had a feeding tube inserted into his nasal passage rings a special sense of poignancy for us. The term feeding tube now has a symbolic meaning it didn't have 3 weeks ago.
Via the Terry Schiavo case.
Because of the Terry Schiavo case and because of the way Catholics themselves have been very much involved in that debate on both sides of the issue with the complexity of wanting to affirm the value of life and at the same time having a transcendent view of the purpose of life and not thinking that keeping a body alive forever is necessarily a divine mandate. So this pope is now going through what he so often preached, which is that we must face suffering with dignity and with a sense of hope and purpose. And he's trying to model for us what he thinks every human life has to be involved in, the drama of suffering and meeting the meaning of life and the end of life.
Mm. Sidney Callahan, your thoughts tonight after the succession of images of the Pope in recent days, coming to the window, trying to speak, unable to speak, he had the tracheotomy, and now reportedly last rites. Your thoughts this evening on this Pope?
Well, I guess we all admire him for different things. He has so many things to be admired. My own most admirable thing I admire him for is his witness to peace. The fact that he spoke out against the war, that he...
The Iraq War, that is.
Yeah, Iraq War, yes, that he has moved the church by himself against capital punishment, that he is pro-life and has tried to have the culture of life in every way, and that's very important that all of these different areas he has sort of said violence is not the way, we must be peaceful.
A Pope of peace. At the same time, Stephen Pope, a fiercely traditional papacy, Pope John Paul II, conservative, at the very least, his more liberal critics call him reactionary. He has asserted church tradition in a very powerful way for many years now.
Well, he has, Tom, but the interesting thing about this Pope is that he defies all the categories of left and right, of conservative and liberal, because as Sidney just mentioned, he took a strong stance against the war in Iraq, which some of his staunchest supporters, indeed his authorized biographer, George Weigel, insisted on as consistent with Catholic ethics. And he's a person who's hard to peg in a way. You're right. Theologically, doctrinally, he's conservative. I would add that peace is a conservative Christian value. It's central to Christian identity. Unfortunately, not all Christians think of it that way, but it really is back to the Gospels for John Paul II. And that's the way he thinks of his basic mission is to keep faithful to the message of Christ and to the teachings of the church that interpret that message.
I think he also is very open to the world. I mean, his efforts to have the church be open to science, to accept evolution, to his great encyclical, I guess, as an intellectual that I love, is the one on faith and reason, that he says there can never be any conflict between faith and reason ultimately because God is the author of both. Well, those are wonderful things to hear.
And he was the one, remind me, he extended the church open arms to Galileo, I think, for the first time since the Renaissance.
Oh, the apologies by themselves have been wonderful acts because the sense of he's living up to Vatican II, talked about being an ever-reforming church, a pilgrim church, and he has made that alive by apologizing to women, to the Jews, to Galileo, and I think he's really given that a strength.
We'll look at all that tonight. I'm just thinking, I'm struck all day today by these back-to-back images on televisions around the world, around America, in any case, of Terry Schiavo and Pope John Paul II. The Catholic Church very strong on this American death, so much in the news. The Vatican Cardinal Martins, reacting to Terry Schiavo's death today, denouncing the removal of her feeding tube as, quote, an attack against God. Stephen Pope, does that convey a Pope John Paul II view of the world of this case?
Well, again, he's complex because he was during his pontificate, a health care directive was issued for Catholic health care institutions that said that it was permissible to deny treatment in cases where care is futile. And that
where it's futile.
Where it's futile and where the a burden on the patient is excessive. The patient is allowed to deny treatment. And at the same time, a year ago in March, he made the statement in an address, not in an official encyclical, but in an address to physicians and healthcare workers, that the giving of nutrition and hydration, water and food, to patients was not going to be considered extraordinary in the language. It was considered natural and therefore obligatory. So there's been a lot of confusion. And that confusion is reflected in the fact that American bishops are now debating publicly, at least trading different ethical perspectives, with the Florida bishop saying one thing and Cardinal McCarrick of Washington, D.C. saying the exact opposite about the rights and duties to those people that are in a persistent vegetative state.
Well, I think we all want to avoid two extremes. One, we certainly don't want to kill people and people who could still live a meaningful life, but we also don't want to prolong death just because technology can make us let us do that. So I think everybody fears both of those extremes, and that's why you have people coming out in different ends of this argument.
Stephen Pope, Sidney Callahan, we're so glad you're with us tonight. We're watching the news coming out of the Vatican in Rome, and we're talking tonight about Pope John Paul II, the second reportedly given the last rites in Rome tonight, looking at the legacy of a charismatic, conservative pope. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join us. What does, what has this pope meant to you? Do you remember how he burst on the scene, the skiing pope, the pope of endless energy? Were you drawn to the fierce traditionalism of Pope John Paul II or repelled by it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Pope John Paul II, reportedly given the last rites at the Vatican tonight, and the legacy of a charismatic, conservative pope. You can join us tonight. What does, what has this pope meant to you? And were you drawn to the fierce traditionalism of Pope John Paul II or turned away by it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined right now from the Vatican in Rome by John Allen, correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He joins us live. John, thanks for being with us. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is just moments ago, Vatican officials are telling us that the Pope appears to be responding well to the antibiotics that are being administered to try to counteract this this infection and this fever that he has. And that his conditions have stabilized is the word that they're using. Obviously, however, the situation remains quite serious. Each of the problems the Pope has, his inability to speak, his breathing difficulties, his infection, taken by themselves, none of them are life-threatening. The concern, however, is this cluster of problems that he's now dealing with, and in his already weakened state, will he be able to summon the energy to recover or not? At this stage, we don't know.
We see Senior Cardinal Christoph Schönborn of Vienna saying earlier today that the Pope is approaching, as far as a person can tell, the end of his life. Is that the mood? Is that the attitude at the Vatican tonight?
The rough answer to that question is no. That is to say, I think what Cardinal Schönborn meant is that he is obviously approaching the end, but I don't think he meant today. And I think most Vatican officials, in their hearts of hearts, believe the Pope is going to pull through this in the sense that he will surmount the immediate crisis that he's facing tonight. But what that is going to mean in terms of how much more time he has or what he's able to do with that time, obviously these are open questions.
John, there's been this question of the Pope's own instructions, if he should be severely incapacitated. Is it clear, is there a point at which he would surrender the papacy? For that matter, given his complex statements about end-of-life treatment, is there a point at which the treatment might, in fact, be extraordinary treatment, be withdrawn from the Pope himself, or not? Or do we know?
I think the short answer is we don't know, and any answer that I could give to that would be in the realm of speculation. I mean, I think it's quite clear that there is no provision in church law for the Pope to transfer the papacy to someone else short of death. There simply is no process for that and very few precedents for it. As far as his own medical care is concerned, so far as we know, he has not left a set of directives. The universal consensus in the Vatican is that if he's not able to speak for himself, it would be his close aide, Archbishop Stanislaw Dziwisz, who would make medical decisions for him. The most recent statement we have from the Pope on point would be a message to a conference last year on the persistent on patients with a persistent vegetative state, in which the Pope argued that provision of food and water to such patients is not a matter of medical care, it's a matter of simple human dignity, and therefore cannot be withdrawn. But that, of course, was the Pope speaking on general principles, not about himself. So to come back to where we began, we don't know.
And finally, John, the atmosphere in Rome at the Vatican tonight, is there is it apprehension? Are the crowds gathered or in line with what we've seen in recent days?
Well, I mean, you have to remember that it is almost 3:30 in the morning here, so there is not an enormous crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square. And in fact, actually, the square is closed off at 11 o'clock, so the people who were there are actually on the exterior of the square. But obviously, I think within the Vatican corridors, there is terrific concern. But that concern should not be seen as any indication that there is a sign or any kind of clear reason to believe that the Pope is in imminent danger of death. I think the deeper reality is this is an elderly person facing multiple problems. Everyone here knows that anything can happen.
And we look on in exactly that spirit tonight. John Allen, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter, joining us there from Rome. Pope John Paul II has been an outspoken supporter of democratic movements in his native Poland and throughout the world. On October 5th, 1995, he addressed the United Nations General Assembly on the UN's 50th anniversary and continued his call for an end to tyranny.
The quest for freedom cannot be suppressed. It arises from a recognition of the inestimable dignity and value of the human person, and it cannot fail to be accompanied by commitment on behalf of the human person. Modern totalitarianism has been, first and foremost, an assault on the dignity of the person, an assault which has gone even to the point of denying the inalienable value of the individual's life.
Pope John Paul II at the United Nations, the UN's 50th anniversary observation in 1995. We are following the Pope's health tonight and looking at his large legacy and long time in the Vatican. I'm joined in the studio in Boston tonight by Stephen Pope, Associate Professor of Theology at Boston College, from Ardsley-on-Hudson, New York, by Sidney Callahan, longtime columnist for the Commonweal magazine, a psychologist who writes on moral theology and ethics, and right now from San Jose, California, by Eric Hansen. He's Donahoe Professor of Political Science at Santa Clara University, author of The Catholic Church in World Politics. Eric Hansen, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
We just heard the Pope speaking there about tyranny. His impact on the geopolitical balance of the planet is already long since been judged enormous. Remind us of his role in the end of the Cold War, in the fall of the Soviet Union.
Certainly the people of the Eastern European bloc deserve the first credit. But when you ask about leadership, you talk about Reagan and the elder Bush from the United States, you talk about Mikhail Gorbachev from the Soviet Union, and you certainly, the third person in that triangle would be John Paul II. He was absolutely essential to bringing together the Polish people. He had three visits to Poland in 1979, 1983, 1987, and encouraging them to hold their national democratic liberation in the face of martial law without being so provocative as to bring in Soviet troops. It was a masterful job, and Poland, of course, is the central case for the end of the Cold War.
It was unforgettable scenes in 1979. He had just been elected the first non-Italian pope in 455 years. Near the end of 1978, and there he was as the Solidarity Movement was rising. It was a kind of laying on of hands by the Catholic leader in a very Catholic country.
Absolutely, and of course, Polish nationalism was always very strongly oriented towards the Catholic Church, and the Poles, in his first visit, so many Poles came out to see him that they all looked around and said, "We are the majority. We can hold our position against this communist government. When I visited Warsaw in 1984, I was amazed at how the Polish people had just basically decided to ignore the communist government. It was an amazing experience.
Stephen Pope, you described this as the first global pope and perhaps his first geopolitical super impact was right there in his home country, Poland.
It sure was. And I think one of the remarkable things about that trip in 1978 is that he could be, in a way, a man for all seasons, because for the conservative Americans, he was the Cold Warrior Pope, the anti-communist Pope, the anti-totalitarian who'd suffered under Soviet dictatorship. But for Catholic leftists and social justice activists, he was the Pope who spearheaded a nonviolent transition of power.
Mm-hmm.
And spearheading is probably too strong, but that's what he's credited with. And I agree with Eric that it's the people that deserve the credit. But he's on the same stature with Martin Luther King Jr. and with Gandhi in shepherding in massive social transformation through nonviolent means. And mm-hmm. I think that forever will be his high watermark in a geopolitical sense.
Sidney Callahan, I wish you could help us understand the formative experiences of this pope that led him to be such a fierce opponent of tyranny in a way that he drew right down to the individual human dignity, human freedom, the cauldron that he came out of in Europe, a very potent one.
Well, if you think about it, he lived under the Nazis, and as soon as they were gone, he lived under the communists, and he saw tyranny at first hand. I think that may have given him some of his fierce conservatism, too, because he sort of emphasized a lot a very authoritarian vision of the Pope. I mean, you have the papacy and the church. It has to be rather separate and very stern and disciplined. And it may have been, that cauldron which he lived and was formed.
In other words, he was raised in opposition to those strong leaders, but yet that was the world he had known, a world of strong authoritarian leaders.
Yes, and I think the idea of some of his emphasis upon celibacy and certain very strict views of sexuality and maybe even some of his rather romantic views of women as being very different and therefore they cannot have the same role as men, that I think came out of a certain romantic and very ascetic view that they needed to survive at that time.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Pope, I'm reading here from our James Carroll, former priest and essayist. He wrote about the Pope's great apology to the Jews, but at the same time, in that context, said, on matters of sexual morality, the rights of women, the prerogatives of an all-male celibate priesthood, religious pluralism, and the dictatorial authority of the hierarchy, he has been reactionary. Fair?
No, I think that's overstating the case. I think you have to take each of those issues in turn. For example, on religious pluralism, this is the pope who has reached out to Jewish people. He's the first pope ever to visit the synagogue in Rome, in an incredible event.
And then to go on to Jerusalem and even to the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall.
And not only that, he put a prayer in a very traditionally Jewish gesture, put a prayer into the wall, and it's a prayer asking for forgiveness. This is something that is not a person who is reactionary. He's opening up.
Well, but yet, this is a man of parts, as you say. The fact that he was so open on certain fronts does not mean he was not closed on others.
I think that he was, for many Catholics in this country, terribly admirable, a beacon for Catholic ecumenical and interreligious relations. I think that within the church, his legacy is a bit more complicated because the context he comes out of is very different than the context in the United States. And I think there are legitimate issues and questions and are going to be difficult for the next pope to deal with, but they have to be dealt with sooner or later. And these are the issues, of course, of women's ordination, of birth control, of divorce and remarriage. And these are very complex, difficult questions.
I also think the idea of collegiality, which was so strong in Vatican II, which he saw himself as being loyal to, but yet everything was centralized, maybe because he was such an awing figure himself, the sense of encouraging the local churches to have their autonomy and to make decisions for themselves. So the the question of freedom of conscience and solidarity and collegiality, all of those, I think, need to be developed.
We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation as we watch the Pope's health in the Vatican this evening. Kathleen's calling from Brewster, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say my prayers for the Pope and tell a story about 1979, and it's great to get this background about what was going on. I was in Washington, D.C. on my way to Ireland with a best friend, and the Pope arrived by helicopter, got into a Pope mobile, and we were like groupies. We were chasing down the Pope mobile, and it was this feeling of such expansion, having been, you know, through Vatican II, raised Catholic. I was thinking, oh, this is it. This
and
is
here he was,
really
so
it.
Vigorous.
Oh, so vigorous. It was so exciting. And I think now I am an interfaith minister ordained in New York City, and I have a friend who's being ordained in the Catholic Church as a woman. And there are things going on that are so under the radar. And in my heart, the way you're talking about the Pope, I think, you know, he is coming from that cauldron, you said, of what he had to go through under tyranny. Mm. And I think in his heart he would be all for this. I know I'm probably naive when I say that, but I think you have to take him from where he came. And also the issue that I just wanted to kind of put out there to the other speakers tonight,
yes,
was I work in a hospice setting.
A hospice setting, this is end-of-life care.
Yeah, end-of-life care. And
very much in the news lately.
Right. I was with a patient today who had been really worked up about the Terri Schiavo case and was Catholic, mm-hmm, is Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at her and I said, I was raised Catholic also. Do you remember it being like this? Wasn't it a celebration to die and to go home to Jesus? And, you know, that's the way I was taught. I had a little sister that died when she was 7, and mm-hmm, the choice was being made to put her on life support or let her go home. And the priest was there, and he, of course, said, of course, you know, you don't want to remember her in any other way but totally alive. You don't want to keep her alive. And it seems like that has changed, and this culture of life, which seems very politically motivated to me, is somehow overriding that, the feeling I had was raised with of death with dignity, you don't prolong life.
Even an element of celebration there. Do you tie that change back to this Pope, Pope John Paul II, Kathleen?
I don't know. I'm asking that question.
It's a great one, and thank you for your memory of that young Pope in Washington. Stephen Pope, here it is. Kathleen, years ago, remembering the excitement, the kind of magnetism and charisma that this Pope projected all over the world, at the same time, looking right around her in her hospice work and wondering what's happened with the sense of how we deal with life and death, and feeling a kind of a hardening of the Church's position. You've pointed to the complexity there, but this is a man who always had both things going on, that tremendous charisma that reached out across lines, but yet he drew lines.
Yes, well, he's a moral teacher, and he's a charismatic leader. I can tell you a little story of my own. The last 3 summers, and I'll continue to do it this summer, I teach a course in Rome, and the last 3 years we went to a papal audience, and I have 15 Boston College students. We try to get there early to get a front row seat.
Yeah.
And these are students. Some are Protestant, some are Jewish, many are Catholic, some are not traditional, some are. It's a good mix. And all of them are almost at the point of swooning when the Pope rides by in his Popemobile. And they take pictures, and they're praying he comes back for a second pass. And they're going to tell their grandmother, and this will be the happiest moment of her life.
And if you questioned them on doctrine and held it stiffly up against the Popes, would it line up, though?
Well, I think
let me just get the end of this story.
That's exactly what I asked them. I said, I know you have tremendous admiration for him. Do you buy his teachings? And they say, we do on social justice and on peace. Some students say we buy the whole thing. Some say we're very selective. It's a mixed bag. What's interesting is that not the celebrity status doesn't always translate into being a moral teacher that they will follow.
Sydney? You think the one of the Pope's role is not only to lead reform and to have unity, but to be a sort of embodiment so people can love him, you know?
Yeah.
And I also felt that. What is all this in the papal audience? What are all these banners and songs and mm-hmm. poems and parades and, you know? And I realized, Catholics love to love the Pope.
And this guy was easy to love for a long time, a very vigorous man struggling for his life tonight. Stephen Pope, Sidney Callahan, Eric Hansen, for whom I have special questions here. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Pope John Paul II, reportedly given the last rites at the Vatican tonight, and the legacy of a charismatic, conservative pope. You can join the conversation. Do you credit Pope John Paul II with bringing down the Berlin Wall? Was he a hero to you then? Is he now? Tonight, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Pope John Paul II, reportedly given the last rites at the Vatican tonight, and the legacy of a charismatic, conservative pope. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you see Pope John Paul II's impact on the Catholic Church, on the world, on the American Catholic Church? What are your thoughts, your prayers tonight on Pope John Paul II? March 23rd, 2000. Pope John Paul II on a visit to the Holy Land in Jerusalem. Here he is calling for mutual respect among all the world's religions.
Not everything has been or will be easy to this coexistence, but we must find in our respective religious traditions the wisdom and the superior motivation to ensure the triumph of mutual understanding and cordial respect. We all agree that religion must be genuinely centered on God, and that our first religious duty is adoration, praise, and thanksgiving.
The Pope in Jerusalem, March 23rd, 2000, they're saying we must ensure the triumph of mutual understanding and respect. It was a historic visit, an apology to the Jewish people, and only one of any number of kind of pilgrimages that this Pope has made across traditional lines. Kenny is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Kenny, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Basically, I just wanted to comment on the fact that I have a lot of respect for the Pope and the papacy in general. I grew up Roman Catholic. My grandparents on my mother's side were Polish immigrants in the turn of the century. I don't necessarily agree with all of his teachings, mainly women as priests. But
his opposition on that front, very strong.
But I do understand at the same time that the Catholic Church is kind of, I guess you would call it, a slow-moving machine, and it takes a lot of time for change in the Catholic Church. And I have a lot of respect for that, too, for that tradition, because it's not like a lot of American churches and a lot of American institutions and the American public in general, to where it's not as quick fix.
A slow moving machine. But let me ask you, Kenny, do you see this Pope as having moved that machine forward or backward? There were some who would say that he, you know, pushed back against Vatican II reforms.
I would say in general he's pushed forward. I mean, obviously with the apologies to the Jewish community past stances of the Catholic Church, as far as Holocaust and things like that. But
so you'd give him credit for forward motion, even as he was a fierce traditionalist, and we hear your Polish American heritage speaking with some pride there as well, Kenny. Thank you for your call, Eric Hansen. I want to turn to you, if we may, for a few more thoughts on this Pope's geopolitical impact. I'm looking here. There's a lot being written today, of course, about the Pope. Here from Reuters, it says he was a strong defender of human rights and religious freedom. His calls for a new world economic order and defense of workers' rights have led some to call him the socialist pope. And yet, he was hardly exactly a liberation theologist. How do you understand the Pope in those terms?
I like Stephen Pope's comments on how complex all of this is. Back to the point of that visit to the Middle East in March of 2000, he went to the Holocaust Museum. He went to a Palestinian refugee camp, and he left the country with the respect of both Palestinians and Israelis. That was a very, very difficult situation to enter. He was the Pope that was perfect for the Cold War, but when the Cold War was over and the whole question became then globalization, I think his two great contributions are, number one, that emphasis on religious dialogue, especially among the religions of the book, and number two, what you just referred to, which is emphasis on North-South relations. And those relations are primarily questions of economic development. In pursuing both interreligious dialogue and questions of economic development, he took a firm stand in support of international organizations, and that, of course, is why you played the tape from the UN.
But what about on the liberation theology front? It had grown strong in the years before the Pope's arrival at the Vatican. His response to that was a very strong South dynamic.
Okay. Again, it's more complex than saying no on liberation theology. Where that particular divide is found is how much openness you leave for the use of violence in liberation and mm-hmm. On that, he, as Stephen referred to, he stood with Gandhi, with Martin Luther King, that the revolution had to be nonviolent. And the other principle that he tended to pursue, and this is where Cardinal fell afoul of him, was to put the emphasis that people who were representatives of the church should also not be representatives of the government at the same time. So you have Cardinal Sin leading the revolution against Marcos in the Philippines. Mm. Cardinal Sin is offered a position in the government following it, and he says no. That's the perfect form for the Pope in terms of liberation against governments on the right.
And, of course, that Philippine movement, a peaceful movement. And then Pope John Paul II's opposition to the Iraq War. Put that in the context of his geopolitical, theological thinking, Eric Hansen.
I'll let Stephen Pope do just war theory, but I'll say this with regard to the Middle East. Paul VI, who preceded him, Vatican policy during Paul VI was probably most closely allied to a moderate Arab state like Jordan. Mm-hmm. That was the closest thing it looked like. Paul VI was not respected by the Israelis. However, what happens with John Paul II and all of his experience with Judaism in Poland, he has instant credibility on Catholic Jewish dialogue. He's taken much more seriously, and he's able to move the Catholic policy in the Middle East into a much more sophisticated position, which can support both Israelis and Palestinians. If he has one piece of unfinished business today, it's that the Oslo process did not work in the year 2000. That would have been a great crowning point for his papacy.
I want to keep our callers in this conversation. Elliot's calling from New York City. Hi, Elliot. You're on the air.
Hello. Excellent program. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an ex-Catholic. I'm 58. I was born during the Pius XII era, and graduated high school through with John the 23rd as our well, not at our school. He was elevated and honored.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my motto. I've lived to find out that Pius the 12th was not quite as pious, I imagine, and as far as authoritarian regimes, the church has got some great credentials in that regard. So, with that as a backdrop, I think Pope John Paul has really done remarkably well, and is a shining light in many ways. Although I was never taken by his charisma, but it was his encyclical on. As well as many of the other actions that have been mentioned, his encyclical, which talked about the culture of death, although reply to abortion, he was talking about war, and he was talking about the machinery of death and a culture of death and genocide throughout the world in Western civilization. I point to that as a turning point for me, in which I gained enormous respect and admiration for him theologically, although politically, you know, he's a representative of an arch-conservative institution, and he's done remarkably well. So I think he gets high grades, definitely up there with John the 23rd.
There's the complexity again. Elliot, thanks for your call. Sidney Callahan, what about this Pope on the culture of life, the culture of death, and the way that his thinking and writing and speaking on these subjects has been filtered into the American conversation most recently around Terri Schiavo? Has it been reflected accurately in this highly political American debate in recent weeks?
Well, I think people take one aspect of it. This is something that happens a lot. One aspect of the culture of life, and they sort of emphasize that instead of taking the whole broad spectrum. Cardinal Bernardine had this wonderful articulated the consistent ethic of life, seamless garment. And that would be what I think the Pope represents, and I would like to see that breadth of pro-life advocacy come back. And so I don't think it's been as well represented in our culture as it might be.
Stephen Pope, has it been too narrowly picked up, the culture of life message of Pope John Paul II?
I think it's been too narrowly interpreted by some people and have used it for their political purposes. Let me make three quick points about the culture of life. First, this Pope has been the most restrictive on the death penalty and has said that it's virtually unnecessary and that we have no place for it in a contemporary world. Secondly, his interpretation of the just war theory is, as Eric pointed, is the most restrictive interpretation any Pope has ever given, almost to the point of him being a pacifist. However, there's a strong presumption against the use of violence, but it's not absolute. So he did say that there was legitimacy to our operations in Afghanistan in response to al-Qaeda and their support by the Taliban, but he hasn't supported our incursions in our work, our military action in the Iraq war. Thirdly, the core principle of liberation theology is the preferential option for the poor. He's publicly, explicitly, repeatedly advocated the preferential option for the poor. So in principle, he's very strongly supportive of liberation. At the same time, on the practical level, the bishops he's appointed in many places have not been strong advocates of social justice. They've been more focused on orthodoxy in the certain interpretation of it.
And how do you explain that?
The reason for that is I think he thinks the biggest opponent of the poor, the biggest danger of the poor in the 80s was Marxism. And he's allergic to any form of Marxism, and he regards it as a kind of a monolithic thing. So his experience in Poland, I believe, set the stage for his interpretation of Marxism in Central America and Latin America as in a kind of distorted way, in certain forms of it. Some forms were dangerous, some forms were not, but he read it in a monolithic way.
And that authoritarian or socialism was his first target, his first enemy. Michael's calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I grew up Polish and, you know, listening to the Pope and his support of solidarity and certainly understand his political experiences and liberation and things. But the Pope, to me, as I grew older, I just saw his reactionary attitudes towards gay rights and women. And from my perspective, he's been just a symbol of oppression, whether it's been in Massachusetts and resistance to programs for gay youth, or against gay marriage. All of these activities have been terribly detrimental to a lot of people, to the point where, you know, their suicide issues for gay youth are, you know, four times higher than most folks. He's been a symbol of oppression to me in my adult life.
Michael, let us pick that up, and thank you for your call. Stephen Pope, you know there are great fans of this Pope, and there are those who feel like Michael, a reactionary Pope, a symbol of oppression, and there are people who are torn between those views. What do you say to Michael's sense of this Catholic leader?
Again, I go back to the complexity. I 100% concur with Michael's judgment that this Pope has not been a Pope for gays and for lesbians. It's a blind spot And I think everybody is he's a human being. He has limitations, and this is one of his limitations. He has great strengths, and he has great weaknesses. And so I think it's important for us neither to vilify him in toto nor to deify him in toto. And both approaches you can find in the spectrum. But I think it's important to see the complexity again.
Sydney, I once heard him at an audience say, we were there at a conference on women's health, and he started his audience saying, "I am the feminist pope."
Yeah.
And everybody laughed, and he repeated, "I am the feminist pope."
He thinks he is, though.
His real respect for women, and you read his writings on women, it comes out. But he does think that women and men are very, very different and have different roles in the church. Now, he just seems to do that by fiat. He hasn't really given much support for that. And so, of course, that means that he also has a very strong feeling that marriage can only be with male and female because they're very different and they must be complementary and it must be geared toward procreation. So all of that, I think, is very strong in his mind, and he doesn't want to have any more discussion or dialogue about that. And it seems to me that's what the next pope is going to have to do.
Sydney Callahan, we can't ignore the sexual scandal that erupted under this pope. Of course, a lot of it predated his time, but a lot of it didn't. His attitude, his impact on that
eruption. I don't know if there's so much there, the sexuality, yes, but more there is the lack of reform and the lack of bringing the laity into participation in the governance, the lack of election of bishops, the lack of all the things that are needed to really live up to Vatican II. The consent of the government governed is, you know, those things which touch all need to be decided by all. That's an ancient Catholic principle. And so when you have bishops being appointed and all of this silence and lack of representation of the priest or the people in a diocese, you're going to get a very situation in which power can be abused. And I think we saw it.
Stephen Pope, our time is almost up tonight. The Pope, responding well to antibiotics, we're told he may come back, but clearly illness is taking its toll on this man. How big a juncture is the Catholic Church approaching with his eventual parting, be it very near or further?
I think we're at a very important juncture, precisely on the issues we've been ending up with.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that there are four major things he has to face: world poverty, Islamic dialogue, bioethics, and the issue of procedural fairness within the church.
A full plate for the Vatican, whoever sits there. Thoughts clearly of many of our listeners tonight for the Pope, who is fighting for his life in Rome. Stephen Pope, Assistant Professor of Theology at Boston College, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Welcome.
And Eric Hansen, Professor of Political Science at Santa Clara University, wonderful of you to join us. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And Sydney Callahan, joining us tonight from Ardsley on Hudson, New York. Wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us, Sydney.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.